So we continue with our work in Chapter 20, The Philosophy of Rebirth, this evening. We found ourselves, when we stopped at a midpoint, Sri Aurobindo was analyzing the various positions on rebirth taken by modern philosophy, by Buddhism, even by Mayavada, and had closed with a footnote that we see on page 777, the CWSA version. In the Buddhist theory, rebirth is imperative because karma compels it. Not a soul, but karma is the link of an apparently continuing consciousness, for the consciousness changes from moment to moment. There is this apparent continuity of consciousness, but there is no real immortal soul taking birth and passing through the death of the body to be reborn in another body. Of course, this chapter is the philosophy of rebirth. So Sri Aurobindo, in analyzing modern philosophy with its materialistic basis and looking at Buddhistic thought, which regards the individual as a concatenation of karmic energies, not a real entity, and looking at Maya, or let's say the Mayavada of Advaita Vedanta, as proposing that there is no true individual, there is only the one unalterable self, true being, is never multiplied, never takes birth, never passes away, simply always is. So he's looking at these three positions, but he will find cause to abandon each as he moves forward. And so we're in the middle of that, and so he continues his argument here. One other thing we might want to note is the difference between rebirth and reincarnation. Buddhism can espouse rebirth, but not reincarnation. Rebirth means this continuing chain of causally connected energies which believe themselves to be an entity, but that is illusory. It is fiction. There is no ultimate thing. But were we to speak about a real being that comes into birth and then recurs in another birth, that would be reincarnation, because it would be a solid soul, so to speak, being reborn. That will eventually be Sri Aurobindo's position, but first we go through these possibilities of whether there is rebirth or not, from materialism, through Buddhism, finally from the position of Mayavada. Now, as promised, we'll continue. As a matter of fact, however, we find a great difference. For the old theories affirm, the modern denies rebirth as a part of the universal process. Modern thought starts from the physical body as the basis of our existence and recognizes the reality of no other world except this material universe. What it sees here is a mental consciousness associated with the life of the body, giving in its birth no sign of previous individual existence and leaving in its end no sign of subsequent individual existence. What was before birth is the material energy with its seed of life, or at best an energy of life force, which persists in the seed transmitted by the parents and gives by its mysterious infusion of past developments into that trifling vehicle a particular mental and physical stamp to the new individual mind and body thus strangely created. What remains after death is the same material energy or life force persisting in the seed, transmitted to the children and active for the farther development of the mental and physical life carried with it. Nothing is left of us except what we so transmit to others, or what the energy which shaped the individual by its preexistent and its surrounding action, by birth and by environment, may take as the result of his life and works into its subsequent action. Whatever may help by chance or by physical law to build the mental and vital constituents and environment of other individuals, that alone can have any survival. Behind both the mental and the physical phenomena, there is perhaps a universal life of which we are individualized, evolutionary, and phenomenal becomings. So, he has just finished talking about modern materialism, that the individual comes into being, sustains itself for a while, and passes out of being, leaving what legacy it has behind simply in terms of material and energetic remains, which continue, perhaps, in other innings and other beings or other becomings, but there is nothing substantial left. So he begins here in the middle, towards the end of this paragraph, another theme. We've done with materialism, now he's turning to universal life. Behind both the mental and the physical phenomena, there is perhaps a universal life of which we are individualized, evolutionary, and phenomenal becomings. This universal life creates a real world and real beings, but the conscious personality in these beings is not, or at least it need not be, the sign or the shape of consciousness of an eternal, nor even of a persistent soul or supraphysical person. There is nothing in this formula of existence compelling us to believe in a psychic entity that outlasts the death of the body. There is here no reason and little room for the admission of rebirth as a part of the scheme of things. So, materialism and this first pass at vitalism, or universal vitalism, do not require the presence of a psyche per se. But what if it were found, with the increase of our knowledge, as certain researches and discoveries seem to presage, that the dependence of the mental being or the psychic entity in us on the body is not so complete as we at first naturally concluded to be from the study of the data of physical existence and the physical universe alone? What if it were found that the human personality survives the death of the body and moves between other planes and this material universe? The prevalent modern idea of a temporary conscious existence would then have to broaden itself and admit a life that has a wider range than the physical universe, and admit, too, a personal individuality not dependent on the material body. It might have practically to readopt the ancient idea of a subtle form or body inhabited by a psychic entity, a psychic or soul entity carrying with it the mental consciousness, or, if there be no such original soul, then the evolved and persistent mental individual would continue after death in the subtle persistent form, which must have been either created for it before this birth, or by the birth itself, or during the life. For either, a psychic entity preexists in other worlds in a subtle form and comes from there with it to its brief earthly sojourn, or the soul develops here in the material world itself, and with it, a psychic body is developed in the course of nature and persists after death in other worlds or by reincarnation here. These would be the two possible alternatives. Well, we'll see that Sri Aurobindo, in a sense, is going to fuse these two ideas in coming pages and chapters. There is an essential psyche. There is a mental and evolved portion of nature that accompanies that psyche into birth. Both, in a sense, are true. An evolving universal life may have developed on Earth the growing personality that has now become ourselves before it entered a human body at all. The soul in us may have evolved in lower life shapes before man was created. In that case, our personality has previously inhabited animal forms, and the subtle body would be a plastic formation carried from birth to birth, but adapting itself to whatever physical shape the soul inhabits. So here, that seed of the psyche would find its way upward in the course of evolution through, presumably even plant inhabitations, through a number of animal forms, and eventuating into the human form. Or the evolving life may be able to build a personality capable of survival, but only in the human form when that is created. This would happen by the force of a sudden growth of mental consciousness and, at the same time, a sheath of subtle mind substance might develop and help to individualize this mental consciousness and would then function as an inner body, just as the gross physical form by its organization at once individualizes and houses the animal mind and life. So there would be this subtler sheath in which the truer mental consciousness would reside in connection with the evolving psychic as it appears and courses through evolving life. On the former supposition, we must admit that the animal too survives the dissolution of the physical body and has some kind of soul formation which, after death, occupies other animal forms on earth and finally a human body. For there is little likelihood that the animal soul passes beyond earth and enters into other planes of life than the physical and constantly returns here until it is ready for the human incarnation. The animal's conscious individualization does not seem sufficient to bear such a transfer or to adapt itself to an otherworldly existence. On the second supposition, the power thus to survive the death of the physical body in other states of existence would only arrive with the human stage of the evolution. If indeed the soul is not such a constructed personality evolved by life, but a persistent, unevolving reality with a terrestrial life and body as its necessary field, the theory of rebirth in the sense of Pythagorean transmigration would have to be admitted. But if it is a persistent, evolving entity, capable of passing beyond the terrestrial stage, then the Indian idea of a passage to other worlds and a return to terrestrial birth would become possible and highly probable. But it would not be inevitable, for it might be supposed that the human personality, once capable of attaining to other planes, need not return from them. It would, naturally, in the absence of some greater compelling reason, pursue its existence upon the higher plane to which it had arisen. It would have finished with the terrestrial life evolution. Only if faced with actual evidence of a return to Earth would a larger supposition be compulsory and the admission of a repeated rebirth in human forms become inevitable. This idea that once the human soul has finished with its incarnation on Earth and can climb into these higher planes of being without a compulsory need to return to Earth is something that was known even in the West, even in early forms of Christianity. Irenaeus, for instance, thought that world after world going heavenwards towards God's throne, so to speak, could be traversed by the ascending soul if there was sufficient merit won in a righteous life upon earth. So he seems here then to affirm that the belt of the animal kingdom is also part of the chain of a forward-moving evolution, and that the psychic essence behind the animal as it incarnates again and again and again has a progressive tone, that it may not be possible for that animal spirit, while it is moving towards the human stage, to rise to a height internatally where it is above the earth. But the suggestion is that it would continue to be incessantly engaged in the process of birth, life, and death until it has reached the human stage, and then would be capable of attaining an immortal existence where one might be seated in superphysical planes above the process of life here on the material earth. To continue, and back to more or less the human state of things. But even then, the developing vitalistic theory need not spiritualize itself, need not admit the real existence of a soul or its immortality or eternity. It might regard the personality still as a phenomenal creation of the universal life by the interaction of life consciousness and physical form and force, but with a wider, more variable, and subtler action of both upon each other and another history than it had at first seen to be possible. So remember, we had finished with materialism. Now he's talking about the universal life and how might that play into the possibility of rebirth. It might even arrive, he writes, at a sort of vitalistic Buddhism, admitting karma, but admitting it only as the action of a universal life force. It would admit as one of its results the continuity of the stream of personality in rebirth by mental association, but might deny any real self for the individual or any eternal being other than this ever-active vital becoming. On the other hand, it might, obeying a turn of thought which is now beginning to gain a little in strength, admit a universal self or cosmic spirit as the primal reality, and life as its power or agent, and so arrive at a form of spiritualized vital monism. In this theory, too, a law of rebirth would be possible, but not inevitable. It might be a phenomenal fact, an actual law of life, but it would not be a logical result of the theory of being and its inevitable consequence. So here, this is life play large. It can assume and, in a sense, instantiate itself without losing its universal poise, but never does the individual aspect of the universal life has independent existence. It would never have independent existence. It would not be an entity surviving in its own form. It would not be independent and freestanding from the universal life which populates itself in these many forms. And now we turn again to a new theme. Advaita of the Mayavada, like Buddhism, started with the already accepted belief, part of the received stock of an antique knowledge of supraphysical planes and worlds and a commerce between them and ours, which determined a passage from Earth, and though this seems to have been a less primitive discovery, a return to Earth of the human personality. So Advaita may start with that because it's drawing from the Upanishads. There is no such mention of such things in the Rig Veda, not really. But we see plenty of instances in the Upanishads. At any rate, he writes, their thought had behind it an ancient perception and even experience, or at least an age-long tradition of a before and after for the personality, which was not confined to the experience of the physical universe. For they based themselves on a view of self and world, which already regarded a supraphysical consciousness as the primary phenomenon, and physical being as only a secondary and dependent phenomenon. It was around these data that they had to determine the nature of the eternal reality and the origin of the phenomenal becoming. Therefore, they admitted the passage of the personality from this to other worlds and its return into form of life upon earth. But the rebirth thus admitted was not, in the Buddhistic view, a real rebirth of a real spiritual person into the forms of material existence. In the later Advaita view, the spiritual reality was there, but its apparent individuality and therefore its birth and rebirth were part of a cosmic illusion, a deceptive but effective construction of universal Maya. So you can see, then, that if we're speaking about rebirth, that none of these positions really endorse the idea of an individual persisting life after life after life, whether it's imposed from above, down, inhabiting this, or growing and evolving from the earth up into conscious immortality. We spend a little more time on that now. In Buddhistic thought, the existence of the self was denied. Anatta, there is no self, says Buddha. There is no self. Pull yourself apart, look for it, you cannot find any self there. There is no being inside you which you can point to and say, this is immortal, at least in the deconstruction of the human personality as we know it. So let's start again. In Buddhistic thought, the existence of the self was denied, and rebirth could only mean a continuity of the ideas, sensations, and actions which constituted a fictitious individual moving between different worlds, let us say, between differently organized planes of idea and sensation. For in fact, it is only the conscious continuity of the flux that creates a phenomenon of self and a phenomenon of personality. In the Advaitic Mayavada, There was the admission of a jivatman, an individual self, and even of a real self of the individual. But this concession to our normal language and ideas ends by being only apparent. Let's read the footnote. The self in this view is one. It cannot be many or multiply itself. There cannot, therefore, be any true individual, only at most a one self, omnipresent and animating each mind and body with the idea of an I. This is Advaita Vedanta's position. So, in Buddhism, there is no fundamental self behind. There's a congeries of energies and forms brought together in a temporary assembly, which, when disassembled, leaves nothing there. But the energy that has instantiated that complex continues along, and so far as it is conscious, it projects itself fictitiously into the future. Believing in itself, it continues to exist, at least for a time. And this is what we normally take to be a soul, according to Buddha. That cannot be the eternal individual to which we would ascribe immortality, and which would be capable of birth and rebirth. It is a complex of energies. Setting that aside, then we have Mayavada's view that there is only the one self, and trenchantly saying, no, this self is simply soul, S-O-L-E. It cannot multiply itself. It has no dynamism. It's intangible. It's apart. It's transcendent. It cannot enter into space and time. So how could there possibly be a birth or a rebirth? That being simply is. And when they admit the idea of a jivatman, jivatman is the individual. It means the living self. So if the atman were the universal self, then the jivatman would be the individualization of that universal self. But that too gets dissolved back into the pure, vast atman as it is. So like a wave again becoming part of the sea, or a drop entering into the ocean, individuality disappears. So there can be no immortality ascribed to an individual, because the individual is part of the ocean, does not exist in and of itself. So now to continue. For it turns out that there is no real and eternal individual, no I or you, and therefore can be no real self of the individual, even no true universal self, but only a self apart from the universe, ever unborn, ever unmodified, ever unaffected by the mutations of phenomena. Birth, life, death, the whole mass of individual and cosmic experience become, in the last resort, no more than an illusion or a temporary phenomenon. Even bondage and release can be only such an illusion, a part of temporal phenomena. They amount only to the conscious continuity of the illusory experiences of the ego, itself a creation of the great illusion, and the cessation of the continuity and the consciousness into the superconsciousness of that which alone was, is, and ever will be, or rather which has nothing to do with time, is forever unborn, timeless, and ineffable. Thus, while in the vitalistic view of things, there is a real universe, and a real, though brief, temporary becoming of individual life, which even though there is no ever-enduring Purusha person, yet gives a considerable importance to our individual experience and actions. For these are truly effective in real becoming. In the Mayavada theory, these things have no real importance or true effect, but only something like a dream consequence. For even release takes place only in the cosmic dream or hallucination by the recognition of the illusion and the cessation of the individualized mind and body. In reality, there is no one bound and no one released, for the sole existent self is untouched by these illusions of the ego. To escape from the all-destroying sterility would be the logical result. Which would be the logical result? We have to lend a practical reality, however false it may be eventually, to this dream consequence and an immense importance to our bondage and individual release, even though the life of the individual is phenomenal only, and to the one real self, both the bondage and the release are and cannot but be non-existent. In this compulsory concession to the tyrannous falsehood of Maya, the sole true importance of life and experience must lie in the measure in which they prepare for the negation of life, for the self-elimination of the individual, for the end of the cosmic illusion. So you can see that this is ultimately what all three of these positions, the materialistic, the vitalistic, and the Mayavadin, lends to us. In materialism, there is nothing, no spirit that inhabits the body. The body comes into being, lives, and goes away. In vitalism, if there is an entity that survives, it's the universal life force. It isn't the individual. And in Mayavada, there is no individual in the first place. This, however, he writes, is an extreme view and consequence of the monistic thesis and the older Advaita Vedantism, starting from the Upanishads, does not go so far. It admits an actual and temporal becoming of the eternal, and therefore a real universe. The individual, too, assumes a sufficient reality, for each individual is in himself the eternal, who has assumed name and form and supports through him the experiences of life turning on an ever-circling wheel of birth in the manifestation. Well, here you could mention the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, that vast tome, the Isha Upanishad, short in compass, but absolutely supporting both the reality of the universe and the individual, the Mundaka Upanishad, certainly the Taittiriya Upanishad, which has wonderful passages describing how the universe is itself the breathing out of the delight of the eternal, and that freed soul which recognizes itself as an aspect, as a drop of that bliss, courses through all the planes of the universe, not just the physical, but all the inner planes and stages of worlds above us, triumphant, ever moving forward, moving with delight as its goal, delight as its engine of progress. Only delight exists. So all of these Upanishads endorse this. We should also mention the Bhagavad Gita, which perhaps has the most beautiful and perfect synthesis of Vedantic philosophy, in which individual and cosmos and transcendent are inextricably supporting and defining each other. Sri Aurobindo then writes, "The wheel is kept in motion by the desire of the individual, which becomes the effective cause of rebirth, and by the mind's turning away from the knowledge of the eternal self to the preoccupations of the temporal becoming. With the sensation of this desire and of this ignorance, the eternal in the individual draws away from the mutations of individual personality and experience into his timeless, impersonal, and immutable being." I think that's a good place to put our bookmarks for this week, and we have a couple of more sections to read in this chapter, which will be a prelude to two other chapters on rebirth. We'll read from Savitri tonight, from Book 7, the Book of Yoga, Canto 2, the Parable of the Search for the Soul. "All the world's possibilities in man are waiting as the tree waits in its seed. His past lives in him. It drives his future's pace. His present's acts fashion his coming fate. The unborn gods hide in his house of life. The demons of the unknown overshadow his mind, casting their dreams into live molds of thought, the molds in which his mind builds out its world. His mind creates around him its universe. All that has been renews in him its birth. All that can be is figured in his soul. Issuing in deeds, it scores on the roads of the world, obscure to the interpreting reason's guess, lines of the secret purpose of the gods. In strange directions runs the intricate plan. Held back from human foresight is their end, and the far intention of some ordering will, or the order of life's arbitrary chance, finds out its settled poise and fated hour. Our surface, watched in vain by reason's gaze, invaded by the impromptus of the unseen, helpless records the accidents of time, the involuntary turns and leaps of life. Only a little of us foresees its steps. Only a little has will and purposed pace. A vast subliminal is man's measureless part. The dim subconscient is his cavern base. Abolished vainly in the walks of time, our past lives still in our unconscious selves, and by the weight of its hidden influences is shaped our future's self-discovery. Thus all is an inevitable chain, and yet a series seems of accidents. The unremembering hours repeat the old acts. Our dead past round our future's ankles clings and drags back the new nature's glorious stride. Or from its buried corpse, old ghosts arise, old thoughts, old longings. Dead passions live again, recur in sleep, or move the waking man to words that force the barrier of the lips, to deeds that suddenly start and o'erleap his head of reason and his guardian will. An old self lurks in the new self we are. Hardly we escape from what we once had been. In the dim gleam of habit's passages, in the subconscious darkling corridors, all things are carried by the porter nerves, and nothing checked by subterranean mind, unstudied by the guardians of the doors, and passed by a blind instinctive memory. The old gang dismissed, old canceled passports serve. So, much love and namaste. Jai Ma. Mm-hmm.